This episode of the Mighty Parenting Podcast is sponsored by SaveTheChildren.org. Save the Children believes that every child deserves to have a future, and in the United States and around the world, they are working every day to give children a healthy start in life, the opportunity to learn, and to be protected from harm. They deliver lasting results for millions of children, including those who are hardest to reach. They do whatever it takes for children, every day, and in times of crisis, transforming their lives in the future we share. Right now, coronavirus is the biggest global health crisis of our lifetime, and it threatens children in every way. COVID-19 has already left many children without caregivers, out of school, and exposed to violence and exploitation. Child poverty is rising during this time. With your support, we can help children in unsafe households and help support distance learning in the face of school closures. So here are some ways that our support can make a difference. We can donate anywhere from $5 to $50 and help vulnerable children. Just a couple of ways that that can help is as little as $5 can provide a nutritious breakfast and lunch for a child who usually relies on school for their food. And donation of $50 can deliver essentials that keep kids learning while they're out of school, things like books and activities and supplies. And there are many more ways that our small contributions can come together to help these children. If you'd like to learn more or make a donation, go to savethechildren.org/savekids. That's www.savethechildren.org/savekids. This episode of the Mighty Parenting Podcast is sponsored by The Great Courses Plus. The Great Courses Plus is something my family and I love. We've enjoyed their courses since before streaming services were even available. So now we can enjoy their courses with the convenience of an app on a digital device. We can all be checking out different things, and we can do it anytime, anywhere. Basically, it's designed to help lifelong learners enjoy and learn and satisfy our curiosity. They also have the basic skills courses, so our kids can get a leg up or a deeper understanding of their science and math and literature courses and things. And yet we can use it to just enjoy ourselves or have fun. We can learn a new hobby. We can learn to play music. We can learn to paint. Lots of different things in there. I know my daughter's been looking at series on volcanoes and is having a great time with that. So I would definitely highly recommend that. And they're offering Mighty Parenting listeners an entire month for free. So to get that free month, you just need to go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/mightyparenting. The plus is spelled out on that, P-L-U-S. So thegreatcoursesplus.com/mightyparenting to start that free month trial. Get in there and dig in and have some fun and do a little learning. And let me know what you decide to watch.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm your host, Sandy Fowler, and I want to remind you to stop by mightyparenting.com and grab your free email series on talking to your teen. And then let me know what you think about it. You can always email me at connect@mightyparenting.com or connect with me on social media. We're at Mighty Parenting, every place that we're on social media. Also, please rate, review, and share the podcast so we can get this information out to other parents. There are other parents out there who want to know, need to know, or might even be struggling, and we want to make sure that we give them all the information and all the support that we can. So, parents, you know, I had little kids and then, whew, made it through the sleep-deprived infant years, the toddler years, the terrible twos or terrible threes, depending on your kid, only to come face-to-face with the crazy, uncharted territory of the teen years. Our teens are certainly a whole different ballgame from the little kids, and they do things sometimes that just baffle us. Well, today's guest knows what they're up to and why. His name is John Madelman. John has been a therapist for over 35 years, and he presents to parents and professionals on topics such as suicide, anxiety, and depression. He is best known for his talk, The Secret Lives of Teens and Tweens. And today he's going to help us explore some of the perplexing and frustrating things our teens do and don't do. So John, welcome to Mighty Parenting.
Great. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
John, I think, you know, every parent has days or weeks or months where we look at our teen and we just wonder, why? Why are you doing that? Why don't you do this other thing? And very specifically in there, you know, one of the common questions that I get as I'm just chatting with parents, whether that's personally or professionally, is, you know, our teens take these crazy risks. They do these things that just seem wild and ridiculous to us. And I kind of want to, you know, dive right into the deep end of this and go, why? Why do they do that? Why take such huge risks?
Okay, there are two things I want to say about that. First of all, we know from lots of studies that the person taking the risk doesn't feel the risk as intensely as the observer. We used to be the risk takers when we were young. Now we're the observer. So that's number one. The other thing to remember is everything a child does, or adult for that matter, but everything a child does, they do for a reason and a good reason to them. It may not be good in terms of their health, their safety, their achievement, getting arrested, but it makes sense to them. And we have to honor that, because if we don't honor that, we can't make any headway in terms of having them look reflectively about their behavior.
Okay, I just have to kind of pause and go back over that statement again. Everything our child does, they do for a reason, and to them, a good reason.
I'll give you a good example from my own life. And I talk about my kids and my wife, they know I do. My son came home drunk when he was in high school. And of course, I was livid, any parent would be. And I said to my son, Jake, I love you, and I know you got drunk for a good reason. He looked at me like I was insane. He toddled her off to bed. And the next day, when he sobered up, it was the next afternoon, alcohol's a depressant, that's what it'll do to you. I said, Jake, do you remember what I said last night? He said, that was so stupid, Dad. You told me I got drunk for a good reason. I said, yes, you did. And my job as a parent is to have you be thoughtful. So you need to write down your reasons why. And he wasn't happy about it, but then he got down to the task. Always interested in alcohol, always interested in being drunk, interested in being very drunk, hanging out with older kids he wanted to impress, hanging out with older athletes he was desperate to make an impression on. And so he broke down for me what his rationale was. Now, we know it's not good in terms of his health, his safety, all those sort of things. But we have to honor that, as opposed to, that was really stupid of you to get drunk. We need to say, I know you got drunk for a reason, a good reason, tell me. And that would include not just drinking, stealing, thoughts of suicide, self-harm. It makes sense to the person. That's the way to start the conversation. Like, I know you did this for a reason and a good reason to you. Tell me a little bit about your thought process. Does that make more sense?
It does. And what was really interesting to me in there is that as parents, when we don't understand why they did it and we jump straight to really a fear-based response of, we have to stop this. We have to make sure this never happens again. And we go down the road of possibly punishment, possibly lecturing, possibly, you know, more of a tearful response. Why would you do this to yourself? But that more emotional, almost manipulative response. When we go those roads, what tends to happen to the kid? What, you know, what do their responses to those reactions tend to be?
Yeah, so what you're saying really is we have to be thoughtful too, and we have to not deal with it personally. It's not a personal thing, and we have to be really thoughtful, and we don't have to decide within 10 seconds. I always say that to parents. So to go back to the story about my son Jake, it took me a whole day to figure out what I wanted to do, and I want to tell you what we ended up doing. We ended up, as a consequence, going to an AA meeting. I would never have thought about that had I said to myself, I have to decide what I'm going to do with this kid in like 5 minutes. It would never have occurred to me, but I had a whole day to make a better decision. And we went to an AA meeting, and it was an incredible experience and a great learning experience. And it was also very connected to what he had done. Does that make sense?
And the reasons he said he did it.
And the reason he said he did it. So I wanted him to see, like, I wasn't saying he was an alcoholic, but I wanted to educate him as opposed to just punish him. And I really learned about when I was angry at my kid, that is the worst time to make a judgment about what we're going to do about it.
Well, and you said, you know, when I'm angry at my kid, and I think that for many of us, anger is that overriding emotion. It's that really explosive thing, what we're feeling. But usually that anger is sitting on top of fear.
Very much so. Yes, very much so. And, you know, worry about kids starts when moms are pregnant. You know, we worry. And then, you know, we get through that and we have a baby. It's like, my goodness, the worrying continues. And then it grows. And when you have a kid who's in high school, you think the finish line is high school. And then they get to college and you think the finish line is college. And there is no finish line for parenting. And that's okay. But we tend to worry about our kids.
Yeah. So the original question we were saying, you know, why do our kids do risky things? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of wondering what, if there are common driving forces, you know, you use this example of, well, they do them for good things. And we need to ask each kid why they did that thing. Do you find in your work with teens and tweens and 20-somethings and families, do you find that there are some common driving forces for our kids to take risky behaviors?
Yeah, well, first of all, the adolescent brain, we used to think it was not very smart, but we know it's very smart. But the adolescent brain, you know, doesn't have a lot of experience to call upon. It's very egocentric. And it doesn't have something that we all have as adults, and that's a braking system. And that braking system says, that's wrong, that's illegal, that's immoral, that I could get me in trouble, I could get hurt physically or emotionally. So they're making those decisions, they're making them very quickly. And also they're guided by a lot of other things. You know, anxious kids, for example, are not making some really good decisions because, you know, when anxiety is really the driver of that. And when I say good decisions, I'm not talking about only risk-taking behaviors. When anxiety competes with almost anything else, it almost always wins. You know, the good basketball player who's very anxious when he's out on the court for this high school basketball game is really a marginal player because anxiety is so powerful. And we know that people do a lot to get out from under anxiety. They'll drink, they'll drug. Self-harm is connected to anxiety. Thoughts of suicide, because when you're in that much pain, you want to get out from under that pain, and you'll go to all sorts of behaviors, suicide being the extreme, but drinking and drugging, because you don't want to feel that pain. We're programmed to, we don't like pain.
Right. We definitely don't like pain. That was actually a conversation I had with someone this morning in a different context. It was, but it's funny. We were talking about adults and we said, yes, in that moment or in that time period, they are living in this situation. They just want the pain and the hurt and the difficulty to stop. They have not clearly thought through or don't have, as you said, the experience to understand what it's going to be like after the fact. And we were talking about adults, and we're talking about adults in their 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yes, so absolutely.
Roll that back to teenagers. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it takes a lot of planning. Like, we all know what to do when we're anxious. We should do yoga. We should, you know, be outside. We should be in the moment. We all know the things to do, but it takes time and planning and sometimes money. And then, like you're saying, roll it back to a younger brain, and they're going to grab for what is going to give them gratification, even if it's not healthy. And that would be self-harm, for example. That would be drinking or drugging or those sort of things, other sorts of risky behaviors, because they're immediate and they're more accessible than planning on going to yoga. That takes a whole different sort of brain and mindset.
And the anxiety piece is very interesting to me. I attended a conference recently where one of the things we looked at was the stress and anxiety levels of teens. And that's another show that we'll be doing, but bottom line is that they're actually not more stressed than they've been in the past, but they are most definitely more anxious.
Yeah, and so, very much so.
this thought that you just shared about, well, doing these things to deal with anxiety takes time. As parents, how can we support our kids or assist our kids who are feeling anxious then?
Yeah. Well, yeah, really good point. Well, the very first thing is to understand that anxiety is real and to acknowledge it. People, oftentimes younger people say, well, it's not a big deal. It is a big deal. We've all been the victim of having someone say something bad to us. Like if I said to you, Sandy, what's the worst thing to say to someone who's anxious? Well, I'll ask you, what's a bad thing to say to someone who's anxious?
Oh, don't worry about it. It's not a problem.
Exactly. Or my favorite, it's all in your head. Well, of course it's all in your head. That's what anxiety is. So we need to at first acknowledge it, and we need to respond in ways that are helpful, as opposed to the ways we just said, which are diminishing and not acknowledging other facts. So that's number one. Secondly, parents often pass along their anxiety. I know I did. Pass along my anxiety about my kids' achievement, about them getting a job in the summer, about all sorts of things, athletically, academically. So we really have to monitor kind of who we are and what we are. And then we have to understand that anxiety lies to us. Anxiety tells us that we're always going to feel this way. We're never going to be better. And so to talk to a young person about these sort of things, but anxiety is very treatable. We know that with medication and therapy and building your toolbox, people can gain the command of their anxiety. They'll never be anxiety free. In fact, we want people to be anxiety. We would not be alive. We need anxiety to live. I mean, that's programmed into us. The other quick thing I want to say is stress and anxiety are two separate things. Parents use those interchangeably, but here's how I remember them. So stress is that tiger that's in front of you that's going to eat you. That's just damn stressful. Anxiety means someone has taken that tiger away. That tiger can't hurt you in any way. But you can't eat, you can't sleep, you can't have joy. That's what anxiety is.
Yeah, and there's a lot there that goes into our nervous systems and all of that.
Yes.
But that's for another day. So I want to kind of focus here on some of these things that our kids are doing or aren't doing. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
obviously, they are feeling badly to varying degrees. They are dealing with things with many of these risk-taking behaviors. And again, if they get into serious trouble, if they get to the point where maybe they are a drug addict or an alcoholic, or they're doing serious self-harm, or they have attempted suicide, the most mm-hmm. common question or commentary or guilt or grief lament that I hear from parents is, why didn't they ask for help? Or when I offered to help, why didn't they accept help? Mm-hmm. What's going on with that?
Let's talk about that. Yeah. First of all, people don't ask for help for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of shame about that. If I had walked in to your office with a broken leg, there would be no shame. You'd probably open up the door and be very solicitous. If I walked into a school or something and I had anxiety or depression or alcoholism, there's a lot of shame about that. And kids pick up on the fact that there's a stigma associated with that. So that's number one. Number two, and very important for parents to realize, is that kids don't like to disappoint their parents. My dad is 94 years old. I still don't like to disappoint my dad. And so when kids are telling a parent or thinking of telling a parent anything, it could be something that, I don't know, maybe they're gay. That's very hard for kids. Maybe they're feeling like they're out of control about their drinking or drugging. They don't do that because they don't like to disappoint their parents. And that is a big driver, one of many drivers, but a big driver that's often overlooked about why people don't ask for help. And they also sometimes think they have to be at rock bottom to ask for help. They've got to be a raging alcoholic. They've got to have to happen for a long period of time. Well, you know, waiting till rock bottom means that you're just digging a bigger hole. And I always say to kids, you don't have to be at rock bottom to call the suicide hotline. You don't have to rock bottom to reach out to your coach you respect, or a parent or a guidance counselor.
That is one of the things that actually we believe in and talk about here at Mighty Parenting. It's one of the reasons we're having these conversations, right? Is so that we all learn more. We learn more coping strategies, and we become more comfortable with having some of these conversations mm-hmm. that have maybe been taboo in your family or and certainly have in our culture. We want to get rid of the shame because the fact of the matter is that mental and behavioral health issues affect more people than the common cold does. And yet we have no problem discussing all the different things that we do to deal with the common cold or the flu. Everybody is out there. Well, at the time that we're recording the interview, it's winter in I'm in Michigan and the flu is going around, schools are closing. So everybody's talking about what they're doing to prevent that. But nobody's talking about what they're doing to manage or prevent stress or anxiety or depression or any of these other mental behavioral health issues. It's not common conversation.
And you just hit on a very important word, shame. Shame is an important driver for all sorts of behaviors. We know shame is a big part of the suicide equation. People feeling shameful for what they've done, what they haven't done, feeling the world will be better without them. So when we add shame into the mix, we know that kids' behavior and adults' behavior is off the charts in terms of things which are destructive for them, things which are hurtful to them emotionally, even physically to them. And if we could eradicate shame magically, then you would see a difference. But there's a lot of shame related to all these sort of at-risk behaviors that you mentioned.
So no, I totally see about the shame thing. Even in a family like mine, where mental behavioral health conversations are frequent and common. And I am talking a lot with my family right now about my practice of working on really feeling and releasing my emotions. We had Jude Bijou on in December, and she talked about, you know, our emotions are energy in motion, and we need to physically release them from our body. And so we have those conversations, and yet when it within the confines of our house and our family, not a problem for me, but I can still see that there are definitely lines for my kids. Like, they're listening, but they're not necessarily talking, or they're still not asking for help. Well, I have one who just doesn't ask for help. And actually, I'd seen a piece recently about people who are very empathic, that have a lot of empathy, that they don't ask for help. Something tied into that being a burden. And that's also something I've heard in suicide prevention, is that
our kids
will attempt suicide because they don't want to be a burden.
Yeah, so, very much so. And
Go ahead.
So yeah, burden is another part of the suicide equation. No one really likes to be a burden to someone else. And that friend that's a burden to us, it takes a lot of work. But in terms of sharing things, you know, you're in your family, you're talking about these things, and that's wonderful. But there's a whole tidal wave out there which is saying, don't talk about it, you know, especially for boys, you know, and just about every culture that I can think of, for boys, it's even tougher. Be a man. Anxious? Nah. Depressed? Not me. You know, and so what you're doing is fantastic, and we all need to be doing that. But then there's a tidal wave out there that we see in movies and TV and online, which is saying boys need to be stoic. And and that message is very powerful. So there's a good reason, just to bring it back to something I said earlier, when people don't share, there's a really good reason why. They don't want to disappoint their parents. The culture saying, don't do this. They think they can work it out on their own. They're not at rock bottom yet, so they don't think they're entitled to help. People sometimes feel like they're not really worthy of help. And we have to understand that too. Everyone is worthy of help. Can you imagine, going back to the early example, if you broke your leg and you waited 2 days, 2 months, 2 years, or never to get help, that's what we do around anxiety. The difference is that when you break your leg, in 6 weeks or 8 weeks, you're going to heal. You're not going to heal from anxiety unless you work at it. And we now know the number one reason on college campuses across this country why kids are going to get counseling help is because of anxiety.
In that list that you gave, the one that really ripped my heart out, I mean, it's sad anytime someone is suffering, can't ask for help. But as a parent, this concept of not being worthy, that one just really hit me, and hit me hard, that our kids would think that they aren't worthy of not just getting help, but of enjoying life, of being free of anxiety or even happy.
Yeah.
So again, as parents, are there things that we could do or things that we're doing that we shouldn't be doing?
I have a couple really good tips. As we've talked about, most kids don't want to talk about it. Mom, dad, I don't want to talk about it. Maybe they don't even have the language. A really good thing to do if your kid won't talk about it, which is a lot of kids, most kids perhaps, is to say, okay, I'm not going to bother you about how you're feeling every day. Because if you ask them, they say, I'm good, I'm bad. It's hard to know what it means. Is to ask them for a number, with 10 being the worst. How are you today? I'm a 7. The next day on, say, Tuesday, how are you? I'm a 4. The next day, I'm a 9. And then parents can build in language like, what would have to happen in your life for you to be a 4 again? And parents can understand in a very quick way, not only where their kids are at, but understand as it relates to another day. I did this with my own son and daughter, and I actually didn't tell them this. I charted it on a calendar because I couldn't figure out if there was a pattern. I knew there was, but I just didn't make sense to me. And interestingly enough, when my kids were in high school, for one of my kids, the most anxious day was Sunday. Why? Think about it, the upcoming week, academic challenges, social challenges, athletic challenges. It changed my whole approach to parenting. I didn't bother my son about homework. I didn't bother him about chores because this was his anxious day. He didn't need anything more from me on that sort of day. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I like this because, one, I think that doing the numbers takes some pressure off our kids. They don't have to come up with words and conversation. And especially, especially in a generation that's used to communicating, utilizing kind of short form, you know, using emojis and pictures and doing things differently than us. They are not as much of a sit down and just talk generation. So I think the numbers hit on that. But then you also tied in the same concept that you taught us at the beginning, which is we need to ask them, you know, and so what would it take in your life? And the thought that also hit me was they may not know. And we, I think, need as parents to be willing to let it go in that moment and say, if they don't have an answer, go, I totally get that. That's not necessarily an easy thing to unpack. Do you think you could think about it and let me know later? And then when do you think you might be able to let me know? And make sure that we have a time to follow up with them. Because I know in my world, I have one who's not real reach out, not real communicative on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So we need to set specific times and go, hey, let's touch base on this Tuesday, or let's touch base on this Saturday evening, or whenever that fits. But to have a definite time, otherwise it just falls off the table. And I don't know if she ever thinks about it or not. And if she does and comes up with something, then that's great. But I feel like it just gets pushed aside if there isn't something coming up. But we still need to respect that.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Here's another really important thing we don't think about. When I talk to parents, I say to parents, how many of you notice you have better conversations with your kids in the car? And every hand goes up. And I'll say why. They'll say, well, they're captive. I said, that's part of it. But the real reason is that we're not in eye-to-eye contact. Because here's what happens. We're talking to our kid about a mental health issue, self-harm, suicide, anxiety, depression. And we're kind of scrunchy up our face. And our kids don't like to disappoint us. So they're reading our face, reacting to our face. And so it makes for a very difficult conversation because you can't be pure. You're not dealing with the issue. Now you're dealing in the moment with mom and dad's reaction to this. So one of the things that I have done with my own kids, and I've recommended, and I know hundreds of parents have tried this, I've got so many emails about it, is to have a conversation in the dark where you're not, it's not really environmentally sound to be driving around for 10 hours. So have it in the dark in your own home where you are literally not having eye contact and you're free, your child is free just to talk without fear of like reacting. And also the other important component is we're talking way too much as parents. And if you think about a teen who's grown up in your home, they've been in your home for 5,000 days. And I say this very lovingly. Even the dumbest teen knows the family rules, family expectations when they've screwed up. And we have to say to our kid what I said to my own kids, and I recommend, you want me to talk or just listen? Mm-hmm. And it's much more important to listen. It's much more important to know how their brain works and what they say. They know right from wrong. They can't always do right from wrong. but they know it.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge as a parent to ask that question and to abide by their answer, because they will say, just listen. Or I'll ask similar questions. It's, you know, they'll say something and they'll say, well, do you want an opinion? Do you want me to help unpack that? Do you want to troubleshoot that? And often the answer is no. And then I have to just clamp my mouth shut, and it is not my strong point. I've gotten much better at it, but we have to respect it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I've done with my own kids is when a child is, you give the child that situation where you say, do you want me to talk or just listen? And you're listening. At the very end, here's what every parent needs to say, thank you. And that's what I've done, because we want to appreciate them. Kids always feel like they're not getting acknowledged enough. Again, it's more important to understand how their brain works. They know the right thing to do. They just can't always do it. So thanking a kid is really important. Because it really acknowledges that, and it puts you in a position to have the next conversation in the dark and the next conversation just to listen. And that's really what we're building toward. Whatever they're dealing with now, it's going to get more and more complicated. So we want to really set some good groundwork to have future conversations.
And that's that relationship building piece too. So many things in what we just talked about build a stronger relationship with our teen. Just that willingness to be there and listen to them and to not be jumping in lets them know that we respect them. We trust them. We have, you know, we value their thoughts and feelings, and that is worth our time to sit and listen to. Again, going back to the, hey, you know, what do you want from me? Essentially, you know, like, do you want me to listen or talk? Do you want an opinion? Do you want, you know, someone to bounce ideas off of? Phrasing those things in a way that truly allows them to choose yes or no, again, goes back to that, hey, I have faith in you. I know you can handle this. I'm here for you. You know, without saying those exact words, it sends those messages. And one of the things I noticed is that as I focused on being more that way with my kids as they went through teens and have moved into their 20s, that it really does change things, and it sinks in. I can see their body language change sometimes in a conversation when I don't jump in, because they know me. Yeah. Like you said, they've lived with me their whole life. They know that I want to help. I want to fix.
Yeah. And it's very important. We have to understand that kids are going to make mistakes. So, you know, if you say to a kid, I know you're going to make mistakes, oftentimes kids will interpret that like, mom and dad think I'm screwing up. They don't have any faith in me. But we have to intellectually know they make mistakes. And you know, we have a lot of talk in education, psychology about, you know, building resilient kids. I have no problem with that, but that is secondary to what I think is most important. And that's what I call generosity. So we know about generosity in the holidays. You might donate time or money to the soup kitchen or something that you think is important. But self-generosity means being generous with yourself and not torturing yourself. Because people who are self-generous don't ruminate about the past and worry about the future. They're more in the moment for the next challenge. And we don't want to have someone say, oh, you've taken a test, you've done badly, that's okay. Kids want to do well. They want to do well for their peers, for themselves, for their parents. So we want to make sure that self-generosity is understood for, it's really uncoupling from all that baggage so you can be ready for the next challenge. And most, for the most part, things are okay. You do poorly in a basketball game or a math test, it's really not the end of the world. And teaching generosity, self-generosity, and importantly, and I'm not very good at it, modeling that is also important. Kids are going to be watching us.
Yeah, that's another one of our, we have a few basic Mighty parenting realities. And one of them is that all these things that we want our kids to do, we need to model it. And we don't have to be good at it. We just have to model the attempt. And in doing that, it opens up those conversations. It's like I said, I'm working on this experiencing emotions thing. So I just have talked about my experiences or, you know, how it's hard, how it's helped me. Just not big, long lectures or something, little conversations or, yeah. or small comments, or I got to let them know that if, you know, if I'm going to go and go, you know what, I'm really sad and I'm going to go sit in the corner and cry. It's a good idea to give them a heads up so people aren't freaking yes. out going, oh my gosh, mom's crying. What's wrong? Right. But doing those things, it does, you know, doing that, modeling it, it allows for the conversations. It allows for the normalizing of emotional wellness strategies and mental health strategies. And eventually it picks up. Last night, my daughter and I were going through and, you know, helping her, listening to her and then helping her unpack some of the thinking she's doing. And it hit me that she was carrying all this emotion around. So I just suggested that she try this technique, and she's been seeing me do it. So she was absolutely receptive. And so mm-hmm. she went outside and broke up the branches from our remaining Christmas tree bits that are out there. And she came in a different person. But
yeah.
if I was in that moment trying to explain, well, there's this idea and you know, emotions right. are energy. If she'd never heard that before, she'd never seen me try it or do it or talk about it, it would have, one, just been a lot harder for her to understand. And two, why should she do something that I'm not even willing to do?
Right. And the beauty of what you did is, you know, kids don't, you know, immediacy is a big piece of this for kids. You know, instant gratification is where it's at for all people, particularly for this generation that's been so influenced by technology and getting things instantly. So that example is a great one. We don't want to plan something. Oh, you can do this, you know, next week and over the next 5 months. No, that's not going to appeal to a kid. They need something that's going to, you know, be a little bit more instant and graphic too, like breaking up branches is visual and kids are very visual.
Yeah. Well, and we had a conversation first. She was like, because I was explaining different ways she could move anger out of her body. Because, you know, the way Jude explained mm-hmm. this to us, this is anger is that outward pushing emotion, which I'm sure you understand, John. And so yeah. it was this move it out, right? And I do a lot of the shaking the steering wheel on my car. That really uh-huh. works for me. But my daughter, uh-huh. she's in martial arts before, and she's like, I need to hit something. Is there anything in this house I can really hit without breaking it? And I'm like, well, you know, like, what about this chair? And she's like, well, I'm going to knock it over. I'm like, fine. So we prop it up against the wall. She's like, and if you do that, I think I'm going to break it. And I'm like, okay, please don't break my chair. But you know, so we kind of had a little bit of fun with it too. And then she went, I'm going to go outside and look for something to break. I went, good plan. You know, so there was a little bit of levity in it, but it did surprise me just how immediate that was and how much she changed before my eyes. She was probably outside for 10 minutes. I don't know. I kind of lost, wasn't paying attention at time. But she came back in and it was just a different person.
Yeah. And you mentioned something really important. Let's talk about anger very briefly. You know, when kids are angry, parents don't like it when kids are angry. Here's what I say to parents. When your kid is angry or at you, you should thank your lucky stars. And I want to tell you why. When anger is outward, that's a safer one than when anger is inward. That's called depression. And when kids are angry at themselves, that leads to depression and anxiety and self-harm and suicide, all sorts of really risky behaviors. So we have to intellectualize and say, all right, I don't really like it, but it's good, it's outward. Now we can deal with it. Also, some kids don't want to talk about emotions. They don't want to talk about these risky behaviors. A thing that I did with one of my kids when they were younger, they're happy to watch a movie. There's so many, you can go online and find a movie around mental health, and they're happy to commentate on any of the characters, and they're smart. They shouldn't have done this. They shouldn't have lied. They shouldn't have gotten high when they were sad. They should have talked to a cat. Like, they know what to do. So if you have a child who's not really good about talking about themselves, think about a transitional object like a movie and watch it together and have them talk about the character. That's a really good way to start, and then making a bridge back to their behavior. I've done it. I've recommended it. I know it works.
Yeah, I can't think of the name of it right now. Several years ago, Pixar came out with their movie about feelings. What was the name of that movie? I can't think of it.
Yeah, it was something like in an Inside Out or something like
Inside
that.
Inside Out. Yes.
Yeah.
And the four of us, my husband and I, and our girls were, I think they were in high school. One might have even been in college, and we all went. And
Yeah.
That movie was the best thing for having discussions about emotions and feelings and the importance of both positive and negative emotions, that, you know, negative emotions aren't a bad thing and that we do need to express them. All of that coming out was so interesting.
Exactly. We parents tend to try something, it fails, and we just keep trying it. So using something that's going to work, like the movie, like I recommended, and you just gave a good example where you used it, kids are happy to talk about someone else. And then, believe me, they'll internalize it. They'll relate it to their own life. You know, you don't have to say, do you see that movie, how it relates to you? No, not necessary. kids will understand it. They're plenty smart. But we're making it easy for them to talk about things, to notice things. And the great part is when a kid can dissect a movie and what has been a risky behavior, what a character should have done, that sort of thing, it's very helpful for parents to see they know intellectually what to do. Now we have to connect the intellectual side, they know what to do, to actually doing it for themselves. Because if you don't have the intellectual knowledge and capability and insight to do it, you can never do it. But once you have the intellectual stuff, that puts you halfway down the road to actually putting it all together.
So how do we help them, once they have the intellectual piece of it, how do we help them make that connection?
Well, let's talk about that. So kids are on their own time frame. You know, it'd be great if they were on our time frame. Like, oh, by ninth grade, they'd be sharing this. By 11th grade, they'd be talking about their feelings. But they're on their own time frame. And we have to understand that they are not us. We oftentimes say, oh, by that age, I was able to X, Y, and Z. It may or may not be true. And we have to really understand that there are people beyond a parent that maybe your child might feel more comfortable talking to. A therapist. I've said to both of my kids, would you rather talk to me or a therapist? My son chose a therapist. I would rather have been me, but you know, he chose a therapist. So I was giving him some power to basically make a choice about talking about things. It could have been a coach who was important to him. But so we have to understand, it doesn't always have to be us, emanate with us, start with us, end with us. It really is other people and other situations that can play really important roles in molding our children in very positive ways.
Okay. So I think that's great. So bottom line, all this conversation we had is that we need to understand that our kids do what they do for a reason, and a reason that is good to them. And we can take that, and I guess I'm thinking even capitalize on it, by instead of being angry and frustrated or scared or sad in the moment, taking a moment or a day or whatever we need to sit and then go, hey, I know you do things for a reason. What was your reason for? Fill in the blank. I love that idea and I love that example. So, but that's the underlying thing, is to give them an opportunity to tell us their reasons for doing something. And then looking for, rather than a punishment, looking for a way of helping to continue to educate them so they can make better choices for themselves.
Right. And I'm not going to say in the example I used that my son never drank after that, but I know it had a profound effect on him. And the one thing we actually can control is us. And that's really what you're saying, Sandy. We can't maybe control their behaviors, their irrational thoughts, but we can control us. And us meaning what we say, how we say it, what messages we're giving. And we all, and I'm pointing to myself too as I'm saying this, we all need to do a better job in controlling us. Because if we can do a better job with us, we're going to do a better job with them.
All right. So we're listening to help our kids avoid, you know, these risky behaviors and to help them not become crippled by anxiety, because everybody has experiences a certain amount of anxiety. What we're trying to avoid is anxiety that becomes a disorder that impacts their ability to live in a healthy way. So both of those things come down to building relationship with them, listening to them, supporting them, and getting into that space of coaching them. Like, okay, so what happened? What were you thinking about? What did you want out of this? What were your, just bottom line, what were your reasons for doing it? But then there's the one key piece that I think we both implied but didn't say, and I want to say it straight out, is we can't judge their reasons once they've opened up to us.
Right. We just have to understand them. That's all we have to do. And we also have to understand that the most important part of parenting has always been stamina. So when your kids are young, you know, you're reading to your kids when they're young, you're reading like Dr. Seuss and you fall asleep. Remember how exhausting that was? And my son used to nudge me and said, "Dad, you fell asleep." I said, "No, I was just thinking about the Cat in the Hat," you know? And stamina is a big part of the equation for parents. And stamina means loving your kid when you don't like their behavior. Stamina means staying up and talk at 10:30 when we're collapsing. And that's when they want to talk. And the parents who have really emerged with really healthy kids and a good relationship on the other side, by and large, are parents who don't give up. Now, that doesn't mean in any given day you can't give up. That's called being, you know, a parent and being a human. But you have to have the stamina to not give up and stay in the game with your kid.
Okay, I love that. And so, John, for anyone who wants to find out more from you, would you share your website?
Sure. It's just my name, John Mattelman. So it's www.jon, there's no H, jonmattelman. .com, and a sense of what I do. And it was really a pleasure to be on the show. Hopefully I'll be back, because I think this is an important topic, and I adore kids, and people who are listening to this adore their kids. That's why they're listening. They don't always adore their behavior, their kids, but they adore their kids.
Yeah. And I'm sure, John, we were talking about the technology and how it's different for our boys and girls. And I know we're going to want to cover that. So we will most definitely have you back on the show and appreciate you being here today.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. And Mighty Parents, thank you for being here today. If you like the podcast, please rate, review, and share it. And thanks just for being part of the Mighty Parenting community. Remember that you are a mighty parent, so you got this. And I will see you next week.